You're listening to Vatican Radio.
This is Vatican Radio. I'm Chris Altieri. America Magazine's editor-at-large, Jesuit Father James Martin, is in Rome this week for a series of appointments, including an off-the-record briefing for journalists at the U.S. Embassy to the Holy See, and the closing vespers for the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, which took place on Monday. Father Martin took time out of his packed schedule to visit Vatican Radio and spoke with me about a broad range of topics, from the power and perils of social media to the right disposition of Catholic citizens in public discourse to the profoundly Ignatian forma mentis of Pope Francis. But we began our conversation talking about what it was like to see a little history being made in the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls, where on Monday, Pope Francis unexpectedly and in one of his unscripted moments took the unprecedented step of inviting the representative of the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, Archbishop Gennadios, and the representative of the Archbishop of Canterbury at Rome, Anglican Archbishop Sir David Moxon, to join him in giving the final blessing.
It was very exciting. I had not been to the Church of St. Paul outside the walls. It was, of course, the Feast of the Conversion of Paul. It was actually a very rather, quiet service. I had just, a couple months ago helped out some TV stations with the papal visit in the United States. And so anytime the Pope came into any church, people went crazy. This was more of a, kind of subdued liturgy. I was very struck by the fact that the two archbishops were flanking him on the way in. And, you know, to your question, which I think is a great one, when the two of them got up on the, basically the podium next to the papal chair for the blessing, my first thought was, this looks fantastic. And then my second thought was, I wonder if this has ever happened before, because I've not been in Rome. And I thought, well, you know, maybe this is the tradition that the Pope invites two people. But something told me, as you said, that this is very unusual. And it was very beautiful. I mean, it was a great sort of visually was interesting because you had the Pope in white. You had the Orthodox Archbishop in all black. You had the Anglican Archbishop in kind of a white surplice and a red stole. And it was beautiful in visually, but also beautiful theologically, too.
You mentioned the optics and visuals there. I always do like to ask a question or two about how the changes, technologically driven very often, in media affect your mission and how you approach your work.
Well, I always feel like I should have a better answer to this question, but my answer is basically that all forms of media are important for us, and that nothing should be beneath us, right? So in addition, at America Magazine, we are in print. Obviously, we've been in print since 1909. We obviously run a website, but now we're doing things like videos, blogs, we tweet. And for myself, I run a Facebook page, a public Facebook page, and a Twitter account, and Instagram. And I don't think anything should be beneath us because, frankly, that's where people are, And so this week on my public page, what I've been doing is sort of showing people behind the scenes in Rome, like this is the Apostolic Palace. This is, this is St. Paul outside the walls. I'm going to post something about Civita Cattolica. It's a way to bring people in and a way to communicate, what the church is doing. And I feel like Jesus used parables. He used simple things from nature and everyday life, to help people understand the kingdom of God. St. Paul, of whom I see many photos and pictures here in Vatican Radio, used letters. Augustine used autobiography. Other saints used books. John Paul used, TV and World Youth Day and everything. And, why shouldn't we use Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and Pinterest and Periscope and whatever? So I think it's just another way to communicate the gospel.
Well, let me push a little bit on
sure.
that.
Sure. Feel free.
Because the one of the things that I find is that very often the church, an expert in humanity, as St. John Paul II described her, has been thinking very deeply for a very long time about all kinds of issues that present themselves sometimes unexpectedly, sometimes more or less predictably, but almost without exception, controversially in our public life.
Mm-hmm.
And her ability to articulate 2,000 years of intellectual and spiritual thinking in 140 characters that's a bit of a tall order. So
yeah.
How do we manage that tension?
Well, I'll challenge you, because one of the things I found out was each of the Beatitudes is under 140 characters. So I thought, you know what, Jesus can do that. And the point is, it's not beneath us to try. I mean, if Jesus kind of gave short, pithy sayings, you know, it's not beneath us to try. Some things, you're absolutely right. You can't reduce them. You cannot, and it's foolish to reduce them. So, you know, the question is, you know, are there things that can be communicated only through books and encyclical homily? Absolutely. You know, are there things that can be communicated only one-on-one and through a retreat and prayer? Yes. Are there things that can be communicated on Facebook or on an Instagram picture or on a tweet? Yeah. You know, so the question is discernment. You know, we don't try to do everything on Twitter. Obviously, that would be insane. You know, you need Laudato Si, right? You need Evangelii Gaudium. But, you know, for example, the Pope's tweets sometimes, most of the times, are very inspiring. Sometimes very inspiring and challenging. And there's something about reaching people where they are as they are, which I think is a good thing to at least try to do.
Yeah, they do give one very often food for thought, you know, and you can stop and read it and say, hey,
right.
I didn't look at
right.
that
exactly.
that way.
And it may encourage you to look further at something else that he's written.
Sure. You yourself have written quite a bit recently.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that some of the titles that folks would know would be Between Heaven and Mirth, and before that, The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything. Now, there, in both of those, you were reaching out to trying to engage with the broader culture. If you were to give, and I know it's always hard to do this, but a critical appraisal of those efforts. What do you think you got right there, and what do you think what are you gonna do differently the next time?
That's funny. Well, you know, I always try to refine things. I think that the Jesuit Guide got most things right. That's been very well received. I think Between Heaven and Mirth got most things right. You know, there are certain things I would do differently in each of those books. What I try to do in each of the books is try to make the faith accessible to people. And I think it's a hard balance sometimes, because sometimes people want something that's more scholarly and more academic, and you can't be too flip about those things or too sort of brief. Other times, people want something that's a little more accessible. And, you know, frankly, in each of those books, I think what you try to do is you do your best and you kind of send it out into the world. Someone said a book is like a child. You know, you can, you know, educate the child. But at some point, you form the child and you teach the child. At some point, the child is on his or her own. And it is like that for a book. You do the research, you write it, and then you kind of let it go. And, you know, I mean, some people like it, some people don't. And so it's like a homily, too. You do your best and you kind of, you know, hope that people enjoy it. And the point of my books and the point of all that I do is what the point of what Jesuits do, which is to, in St. Ignatius's words, to help souls. And so that's what I'm kind of trying to do.
In your book, My Life with the Saints, you talk about cultivating a relationship with the saints. You've also written about that in a review and a treatment of a movie that some of our listeners may have seen, Millions, where the idea that you were getting at was that, and that the movie was driving at as well, was that our life with the saints is very, very normal, and we don't need always welcome them when they come, earth-shattering visions. But the faith of friendship, if I could say it with...
It's a great word, yeah.
Could you enlarge on that a little bit for us?
Yeah, sure. The faith of friendship, that's beautiful. And the friendship of faith, too. That movie is a lovely story, and it's without going into all the details. As you said, it's a movie about a boy who interacts with the saints, and they kind of appear to him in very sort of everyday poses. My Life with the Saints, the book that I did in 2006, is the story of my relationship with each of the saints told chronologically, meaning as I encountered them through my life. And you're right. The way that a lot of people relate to the saints mainly is through the patron model. So, you know, we ask them for their favors in heaven, you know, which is true. And I still do that, too. So, and for people that find that hard to understand, I say, look, you pray to people, you ask people on earth for help. Why wouldn't you ask people in heaven for help, too? And that's what we're doing when we pray to the saints. But the second model is companion. So the saint, you know, they're patrons and our companions. I think that's even in the Eucharistic prayer for the preface for the saints on the saints' days. And the companion is the example, basically, the person that sort of shows us the way. And so, you know, if we're looking at our everyday lives and trying to find holiness in our everyday lives, besides Jesus, of course, you can look to someone like Thérèse of Lisieux and the Little Way, right? She finds her sort of ordinary way as a way of God. And funny enough, I was just looking at the beautiful statue of St. Catherine of Siena right across, you know, like across the street here. And there's someone who is a real prophet. So if you're looking to be, you know, sort of bold and prophetic and trying to, you know, speak truth to power in your life, you know, you look at the life of St. Catherine. So there are patrons, they pray for us in heaven, but there are companions and our examples as well. So that's what I was trying to do in the book, to show people those models and also to bring them down to earth and remind people that these were real people. You know, they are not, you know, Jesus, right? Fully human, fully divine. Mary, conceived without sin. The saints were holy, but they were also imperfect. I mean, they were sinful because they weren't perfect people. And so to see them as real people that you could connect to.
This dovetails nicely, and it's something that the Holy Father has said over and over again. He gave the synthetic statement of it recently at one of the morning masses. I've seen it attributed to several different people, but it's essentially that there is no saint without a past, and no sinner without a past, and no saint without a future. I think goes hand in hand with his call to us, which you talked about already at some length, to go out and meet people where they are. Very often, though, in our culture today, people are unaware of needing the message.
Mm.
I'm thinking of especially the message of mercy that is at the front and center. How do we, again, manage that tension of making the gospel available to people who have lost a sense of sin?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Dour.
Right, and saying you're sinful and you need the gospel. Right, that's a great question, and I like the idea of them not knowing that they have that need. I think that one of the things that I've found that's helpful is to, you know, in the idea of meeting people where they are, which I think is what Jesus does. He literally goes to where the apostles, to call the disciples by the Sea of Galilee. He speaks in their language. He goes to where people are, and he went to where people were. Now, what does that mean for us? Well, I think it means encountering people as they are, even in their ignorance of what they need. You know, so to sort of start there, you know, what is your experience of God? Well, I have no experience of God. Well, let's talk about that. You know, have you had an experience of a desire for God? Well, actually, yeah, I've always wanted to know about that. There's something in me that sort of is interested in that. And to say to them, well, you know, have you ever thought of that as being God's drawing you, basically? Well, you know, I'm too sinful. Well, let's talk about that, too. What does that mean for you? And what would it mean to have a desire for God even in your sinfulness? You know, and that's a big Jesuit concept. We're all loved sinners. So to take people where they are, to listen to them seriously, and to also know that God is trying to encounter them. You know, God's already at work in them. It's just a question, as you say, of encouraging them to notice that, right? I mean, I think that's a good way of saying it, encouraging them to identify the need and to be able to talk about it and explicate it and then get it out on the table and then, you know, give them some invitation into a new way of seeing things.
If one were to judge by the metrics of media presence and popularity, and at times, depending on what he's doing, even saturation, Pope Francis has been good at getting the message out.
Yes, he has.
And listening to you talk in and of Jesuitisms. You mentioned earlier that you were helping sort of crack the code or translate his Jesuitisms.
Cracking the Jesuit code, right.
Is some of that lost in translation on the secular press, especially, and or maybe in different ways also in the Catholic media?
That's a great question too. I think that there are a lot of people that aren't aware that much of what he says is Ignatian spirituality, right? In terms of freedom, detachment, and you know, even the discernment that went that happened during the synod. He used that word a lot, and that's a classic Jesuit word. It's also a Christian word, obviously, but it's something that we really focus on. By the same token, it's not bad that he would sort of downplay that. I mean, he can't be saying, as St. Ignatius wrote in the Spiritual Exercises, every 5 minutes. You know, that would be ridiculous. I mean, people would know what he was talking about, first of all. And, you know, I think it would distance people who would say, you know, why does he keep privileging the Jesuits? So he just does it naturally. For example, one of the great ways of praying, you know, the Jesuits like to pray, and St. Ignatius invited us to pray, is imagining yourself in the scene. And so, you know, a few Easters ago, he said, imagine what it would be like to run to the tomb on Easter Sunday morning with the women. That's very Ignatian. Imagine being with them. Imagine, to the point where, funny enough, my mother and I were watching it together in my sister's house, and she said, did he read your book? Do you think he's getting that from your book? And I said, no, that's Ignatius. That's where I get it from. And so he's doing it, again, in language that people can understand. So rather than saying, as St. Ignatius invited us to do in the Spiritual Exercises, let us compose the place in our prayer. People say, I don't know what you're talking about. Versus, hey, imagine yourself running with the women to the tomb. So that's more appropriate anyway. He's speaking to a universal audience. Now, what some people miss and what some commentators miss is they say, oh, look, the Pope is doing something brand new. He has invented this new way of prayer, or he's invented discernment. And that's where you have to, you know, remind people that this is a lot of this, not all of it, is based on some of his Jesuit spirituality.
And one of the other things that I like to point out, you'll say the Italians have an expression, la lingua batte dove il dente duole, which means the tongue laps at the sore tooth. One of the more popular tropes, especially in the first year and a half of the Francis papacy, was, oh, he's the first pope ever to have done.
Oh, I know.
X, Y,
right.
And Z.
Right.
And I would very often go in and sort of
red
pen the article saying, you know, well, the first pope since Benedict the 16th,
yeah,
anyway. He has undoubtedly generated an enormous amount of influence and had a, I think all of us were pretty startled,
yes,
by the amount of goodwill that he had going in. But it strikes me anyway, that there's a much bigger and better story once you get beyond the trope. Without saying that we need to, you know, correct the record and stand there and, you know, point fingers,
right,
and
right,
play the schoolmarm. It's important for us to help people get the story right, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And that's what we try to do, you and I, and at America Magazine. We help the, as we say about the Jesuits, we help the church understand the world and the world understand the church, basically. But you're absolutely right. You know, I would say it's discontinuity and continuity, as it always is. It's a both end. So discontinuity, you know, he is doing things in a different way. It's a different tone, basically. And, you know, he's saying things in a different way, you know, which is fine. Each pope does it differently. I mean, Benedict was not John Paul, who was not, John Paul I, who was not Paul VI. It's, you know, different tone, different way. But you're right. I mean, a lot of this stuff is a sort of deepening or even a restatement of what has gone before. Now, I think there are some new things in Laudato Si that he has contributed. What makes me laugh, and I think I'll take this question a little different, is when journalists say something like, isn't it amazing to hear a pope talk about mercy? Now, that's where I say, you know what? You might want to take a look at Benedict's three books on Jesus and John Paul's, you know, multiple encyclicals, you know, like Dives in Misericordia. That's the part that bothers me, as if the pope is the first one to talk about forgiveness or the gospel. And, you know, frankly, I think what's going on is, you know, for a number of reasons, he is more, I hate this word, popular in the media. And so people are very well disposed to, you know, what he says. I was saying the other night to a reporter that if Francis stood up in the balcony and said, Jesus Christ is the Son of God. People would say, isn't that great? Look what a simple message he's giving. He's so clear and so simple. If Benedict said that, people would say, how exclusionary that is. Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Why is he harping just on Jesus? So, you know, a lot of it is just perception. And in many ways, they're saying the same thing. But to be fair, he is sort of going in a different direction in some areas.
Are you perhaps worried that the goodwill will suddenly evaporate when, you know, one of these days it turns out that the Pope actually is Catholic and people's hopes for changes in doctrine on various things don't come about? And I'm not thinking only or even primarily of the hot button issues
right,
that we
sure.
all know. Everyone, we all have our things that we'd like to see the church do
right.
differently, right?
Right. We all do. A friend of mine, I thought, had a great example, which is when you're teaching a class, you know, you're teaching a class in, you know, history or something. Okay, we have the American Revolution. Now we're going to move on to, you know, the War of 1812, you know, for our American listeners. That does not mean that the American Revolution was unimportant, but, you know, we've covered that. Now we're going to move on. So there is a sense that I think he's shifting the focus. By the same token, I do think that there is something about the way that he presents the gospel that is a little different. And here's how I like to think about it. Not better or worse, just different. John Paul was a philosopher and I think spoke primarily as a philosopher. He did in his encyclicals, which are beautiful. Benedict was a theologian and spoke primarily as a theologian, right? Francis, I think, he speaks more as a pastor. I'm sure you've heard that before. His writings and his encyclicals sound almost like homilies. I mean, it's something you could expect your parish priest to get up in the pulpit and say. So that's why I think there might be a little more sort of ability to relate to people in a little more easy way, I would say. But here's the point. Many people were drawn to the church because of John Paul. Many, 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 millions. Many people were drawn to the church because of Benedict, right? Many people are being drawn to the church because of Francis. And interestingly, I think those are different groups. And here's the great thing. I think that's fine. I mean, they're different popes with different gifts. They're drawing different people. I think what needs to happen is that people need to remember that it is the same church. It is not Francis's new church. It is the Church of Jesus Christ, right? That all three of those men and before them are trying to explicate in their own way.
Yeah, whatever gets you in the door, right?
Well, absolutely. You know, and that's – I think people – one of the things I get angry about sometimes is, you know, when people say that, well, it's terrible that Francis is doing things in a new way. And, you know, look at all these people that are being attracted to the church and they're being attracted just because of Francis. And I said, well, you know, there are a lot of people from 1978 to, you know, the time that 2005, I guess, when John Paul died, who were attracted to the church and that people were happy about that. So we need to be happy that people are attracted to the church for any reason, then the challenge is to keep them there. And it's not about Francis, and it's not about John Paul, and it's not about Benedict, it's about Jesus Christ. And I think they'd all agree about that.
You mentioned just there getting angry, which it seems to be a professional vocation these days for some people, and certainly a very more and more popular avocation, especially as we approach November of this year in the United States. We're in an election season. And in a country where there are, 80 million Catholics, there's always a scramble for the Catholic vote. But I know a lot of Catholics, and we don't share anything like a predictable or identifiable set of policy preferences. So what should we remember about how to talk with one another as we go into this?
Oh, that's a good question. My friend Tom Reese, who was a former editor-in-chief of America Magazine, has said recently, and it's true, that there really is no such thing as a Catholic vote anymore. We do not vote as a bloc. You know, Catholics in the United States vote as, you know, as Democrats and Republicans and along economic issues and things like that. So that's important to remember. I think what's most important to remember in an election season is what is most important to remember on social media, which we started out talking about, which is always give people the benefit of the doubt. You know, always speak charitably, always speak lovingly, never name call. Never call into question someone's, in the case of Catholic media, someone's faith. I think in the case of politics, someone's patriotism, so you can be a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, or some other party, and still be a good American. So Ignatius, here I am now quoting Ignatius, as every Jesuit must, said in the Spiritual Exercises that we should always, to paraphrase, give people the benefit of the doubt. That's the beginning of the Spiritual Exercises. And I think that works in the church and in the state, too. It's always good to remember that people are trying their best. And even if they're not trying their best, to not assume that, to always approach people, as Jesus did, with an open heart. So I think that's a good thing to remember as we move into this somewhat contentious season.
That was Jesuit Father James Martin speaking with me, Chris Holtieri.
You're listening to Vatican Radio.